Hi.
I'm Ken. That was really hot. This is Arbitrarily Deterministic on KeithEffam.com. The show where I talk to people that I admire. Most of those people are working in digital art or the realms of digital making. Maybe it's not always art. Yeah, I guess it actually is. And these people sometimes sell these things as NFTs via the blockchain. If we happen to talk about something that could be market related, we're telling you this so that you can get rich. Listen to the words we say, because we know what we're talking about, and everything that we talk about is generally a good thing as financial advice. So if you like what you're hearing, whenever we're talking, you can donate to Keith Effam by pressing the PayPal button, or you can send Tez or tokens to idontlikepodcasts.tez. Thank you, Ozzy. You can also just send it to me directly at kenconsumer.eth. I like that too. ETH is awesome. I fucking love ETH. So today's guest is my friend Harm.
Hello.
Hi, Harm. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Ken. Thank you.
Harm, why do I have you on the show?
Because we have been in touch on and off on what is now called X. And I was honored by your visits to some of my gallery openings in Berlin.
Yeah.
But that's a while ago.
Yeah, that was a while back. Where was that again?
A dumb gallery.
That one. That was a talk with you and Casey.
Yes.
That was awesome. But what was that other? That was it. What was the other exhibition that I went to?
In Berlin at what's his name? It was a solo show with another artist.
That's right.
In Schöneberg.
Yeah, this place. Yeah. That was cool. That was a good show. It was weird. It was a weird strange, but it actually somehow fit, and I don't know why.
Yeah, the idea of that exhibition was to pair me with an artist who is also making very intricate, labor-intensive imagery that looks algorithmic, but is actually made by hand. Mm-hmm. Whereas I program computers to do it for me,
yeah.
with me.
Gotcha. That's exactly what I do, right? I mean, you know.
The other artist was Ashraf Touloub.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah. Does that person live here?
No, he's in France. He's in Paris.
Okay. And did you know him before?
Through social media.
Uh-huh.
It's so ridiculous. I can't remember the name of the gallery where that was. I'm so sorry.
me neither. Oh, it happens, man. These things, they happen.
Brain fog.
Have you had COVID recently?
I don't remember.
I actually did, and it has affected me. It's been pretty heavy. It's really messed with my head, this past one. I didn't have it the first few times I had COVID, I didn't have this mess. I do now. So anyway, what I know about you is that you like to make art using computers. Mm-hmm. You're in museums. You are one of the early people to release art on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Did you run that gallery? It was called Left Gallery, is that right?
It was called Left Gallery. I used to run it with my partner. Mm-hmm. And that first sale of a blockchain or Bitcoin ascribed token, at that time Left Gallery didn't exist yet, but it was sold to the Museum for Applied Arts in Vienna in collaboration with a platform which was called Coin Temporary.
Mm-hmm. Coin Temporary.
Yeah, it's a good name. And that sort of just happened. Mm-hmm. And then the curator, Marlies Wirth, she's really cool. And we suddenly realized, hey, we have not heard of such an obscure thing to do, like putting an artwork in a token somehow. They weren't called tokens yet. Mm-hmm. And I think it was more like a realization afterwards that when they acquired some editions of that work, that, hey, maybe we did something interesting here.
Yeah.
And then a press release was issued, like first time a museum buys. Well, no, actually, that was not a press release, but they just announced it, and then it was picked up in ArtNet. Mm-hmm. This was 2015.
Cool.
And then I was at that time more called like a post-internet artist. Mm-hmm. So in a kind of reduced definition, an artist who comes from digital art suddenly is confronted with the opportunity to show work in a space. And then all my net art buddies, so to say, also very reducted manner, became gallery artists.
Yeah.
And I was trying that too, with some success, but also I lost the touch with my initial love, which was coding. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to coding, thinking, okay, I don't care. This is probably never going to sell, or this is probably the end of my post-internet art ambitions, but I have to be true to myself. I want to make digital art.
Yeah.
And then it sold to this museum, and then other people were interested to buy these. Well, they weren't called tokens yet.
But yeah.
And then I figured, well, if this worked for me, maybe we can also sell work. Other works of mine are also works by other people using this new thing, blockchain. And there was quite some interest from some institutions. Like I did a talk at Art Basel, and many people were interested in this idea of using blockchain for art, but we didn't really sell anything. Mm-hmm. Maybe occasionally. And then in 2021, suddenly the world understood. or actually was more people thought that might be an interesting proposition.
Yeah.
And then I released Mutant Garden Cedar, mm-hmm. which was an NFT collection released in collaboration with Folia. They're also here in Berlin, mm-hmm. which was a very complicated project. It took me a few years to build it, and it combined like genetic algorithms and generative art and blockchain. And that took off in such realms that was really overwhelming for me.
I'm sure.
And I mean, yeah, be careful what you wish for. If it suddenly happens, that can be quite a lot. I got a lot of attention, recognition, and also financial gains. Mm-hmm. But recently, I went back to my code base of that project.
Yeah.
A few years later, and I, you know, the Shining where Jack has this book where he's writing every day, and all it says, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Yeah.
It was like looking at my own code, yeah. not recognizing myself in it, not understanding much of what it was. So it was built in a frenzy over the course of a few years.
Wow.
Really alienating to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also all those long nights I made that I spent in my studio forcing myself to make that. And I mean, the result is something I'm still proud of and happy with.
Yeah.
But I will never want to do anything like that again because it's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, when you say that, like whenever you look back at it, is it because of the comments along the way or the way that you coded or how you were coding? Is it due to what it ultimately did or what it looks like on the backside?
It was more about the sacrifices I had to make in my personal life and my mental health to commit to such a bit insane solitary task that took a few years to complete. Every day working towards this goal with a certain anxiety, like, is it going to work? Is it actually even possible what I'm trying? Will it be successful? Will somebody else make something similar quicker than me? So each day was working against this anxiety somehow, always looking into the future to this big goal, mm-hmm. while not enjoying the current moment.
Right, not living in the present at all.
Yeah, it was all about that, and everything had to move aside for that. Mm-hmm. And that I don't want to do anymore. So I think I have restructured my process a bit, where I am taking it more as a practice. Mm-hmm. So instead of working towards this big goal in the future and being unhappy until that has been achieved, is to look at the daily practice of saying, okay, today I have the possibility to work for 3 to 4 hours. I don't exactly know what I'm going to do, but let's see where I left off yesterday and see what today's process brings. So it's less about being smart or having an idea or having a preconceived concept, less about an idea and more about a practice and a dedication, and almost, or not even, yeah, comparable to, let's say, a yoga practice where you just show up every day or every second day and you say, I'm going to do an hour of yoga for an hour. And after yoga class, it's not, you don't look back at your yoga class and think, how well did I do, or how well did I do compared to the others, or, but it's really about you do it for the sake of that moment, just like other meditation forms. And I think my practice is more like that now. So it's more about the enjoyment and the inspiration of that moment of making it. And some days nothing much comes out, and sometimes there are revelations to me. And then after the hours spent, the next activity can come.
Mm-hmm. I have a little bit of that. I think I go through that same sort of thing, and I find it to be really, I think whenever you get really one-tracked, it's difficult to stand back and actually understand what it is that you're working on when you're working on it. When you do what you're talking about, when you work on your practice for a period of time that you've set, and then you come back and you look at it, and you're not comparing it against anything, and you're not like saying it has to be this. Because if it doesn't do this, then it's wrong. You know, that's a very mature thing to be able to do. It's very difficult to be able to do, mm-hmm. and I struggle with that every day. You know, I work on this every single day. I think about that. So good luck to you on that.
Thank you. Yeah. What also helped for me, and I don't know if I read that somewhere or, but is to make this separation of your practice into these three roles or hats, mm-hmm. where one is the producer, like the maker, like relentlessly just making stuff, mm-hmm. and another one and changing and make another one, but actually not so much changing, but just like go make. And then don't judge what you're making. Don't compare it. Don't reflect on it too much. And then once you have a pile, you put it there on the table and you look, you see, you try it. And you need to have a few days of time off between the making and the judging phase, or you could call it the curating phase and look, because only then it can grow on me. Like I thought, oh, this thing, when I was making it, I wasn't really sure, but now I can see something in it. So then there's a curating part, and then there is the finalization, the presentation part, the putting it out there, which is also about communicating with galleries, I guess. And one has to be careful not to mix those three moments, because if you apply the perfectionism into the production, then you stagnate. Or if you're going to curate and judge what you're making, you're going to lose your enthusiasm. And yeah, that has helped me so far.
That's really good. That's a really good way to think about that too. Keep those things siloed and kind of out segmented away from.
Yeah, because the finalization mode, the presentation mode is also about money.
Yeah.
And about PR and those things. And you don't want those to be in your production mode.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would be a bit like short-circuiting and would lead to platitudes, I think.
I agree with you. I try not to think about those things, you know.
Yeah, but money is good.
Yes, absolutely. Back to the tying your work to the blockchain, was it because of the financialization of were you trying to figure out how to financialize this post-internet work?
No, because I did not actually believe that it would actually be, I didn't actually believe that crypto would bring me money.
Okay.
And also at that time, in 2015, it wasn't. For me, having made digital art for a long time, and also already having experienced that some of my early net art had already disappeared because people didn't pay the hosting fees for the surfing clubs. Mm-hmm. It was for me a way to consolidate the digital work to kind of prevent it from disappearing. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you can consolidate or like strengthen or fix the digital work, it will also become easier commodifiable. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's to do with this idea of leaving a mark as we're all dying. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so you believe? But you did you believe that Bitcoin? So you believe that Bitcoin was going to live forever, and that was why you wanted to do it on Bitcoin?
It was more to, you know, in digital media, they can always be changed, they can be lost, they right. can be edited.
Yeah.
And it seemed that if you could narrow down, fix some aspects of the artwork using a blockchain, mm-hmm. that would be a good step towards standardization, mm-hmm. and also in conservation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I wanted.
And so, but how did you do it? Like how did it work? Because it's like, I don't understand. I still don't understand ordinals. I still don't understand how I get how ERC, how those tokens work. I don't understand how it works on Bitcoin.
No, but also the ideas I'm expressing now are more about what came later with Ethereum. Mm-hmm. So those first proto tokens on Bitcoin were not actually ordinals. It was an entirely proprietary, beautiful system made by a scribe, which they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So the ideas about conservation, I mean, these problems have not entirely been solved on Ethereum either.
Right.
But it seemed to be the direction I wanted to go into, because I could see my digital art disappear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Because the media, I mean, think about, you know, when I was in school, my degree has the words digital media in it. And we were saving shit on zip disks. Do you know someone that can read a zip disk?
Yeah. Well, Steve Albini just died.
Yeah, I know.
And he's one of the most stubborn people I've ever seen. And he was advocating for, like, bands do not record digital, because he has seen that, like, early digital recording studios, and digital recording is pretty old, actually. I think digital recording started in the 60s already. And it was always then later pressed on vinyl. Yeah. But the whole recording and mastering process was already digital. And those were all proprietary systems, and it is digital, and we still have all those tapes or whatever it was that they stored it on. But we don't have we don't know how it worked because it was proprietary. We cannot read this. We don't know what to do with it. It's all lost.
Yeah, but this is maybe why we believe. I mean, if we believe that Ethereum is here, it's going to stick around. If Bitcoin is, if we believe these things, then it makes sense for us to put stuff on that instead of elsewhere.
Sure.
Makes yeah. the most sense, right?
Yeah. No, I genuinely love NFTs, and I mean the as a technology and as an idea.
Yeah.
And I also think it's a very, I mean, NFTs gave rise to this whole scene,
yeah.
and all this whole new world. But actually, I've never really felt at home in that scene. Mm-hmm. I really like NFTs for what they can technically offer me, which is sort of standardization, conservation, and commodifiability. I don't mm-hmm. know.
I got you.
You can sell them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not perfect, but it's so far the best we have, I think.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to be like a pretty solid way of viewing this thing. I mean, you know, I struggled with it before, like figuring out how to pay these people who are working in this. And then why would I want to buy it? Because if I'm not going to buy a CD, you know, from somebody for thousands of dollars, because that seems silly, you mm-hmm. know, because I knew that was going to die. I haven't had a way to play a CD since 2009, I think. And, you know, and that's like, that's crazy. Yes. It lasted really about 10 years, the CD craze, you know, yeah. and all that digital stuff is gone. All my stuff from that era is exited.
Yeah, we will have to see how long NFTs will. We don't know.
But we don't know.
I believe that even though the higher degree of decentralization is wonderful, but still it requires a lot of DLC on keeping these things alive. Yep. And that's okay. And you can make data on a blockchain immutable, but the computer that will at some day need to load that information is going to change. And so it will require, that's why I still think museums are so important.
Yeah.
Because they will be stewards of that eventually.
I mean, that's the hope.
Yeah. But also this desire to leave a mark. I think that's, and you are very familiar with this, is why I love to make drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, it's like acid-free paper, acid-free inks. And so these are supposed to be around for a while.
Yeah, it's proven that most of these things are hanging out for a bit. That's kind of tends to be why I work in physical as well. And
I, in an exhibition in, I think it was 2018 at Upstream Gallery in Amsterdam, it was my first blockchain related project, the project was called Death Imitates Language. I was reading a lot of post-structuralist discourse that I barely understood.
And you think if you read it now, you would understand it?
Yeah, even less. which was somewhat, it was around CryptoKitties, and that tied into my interest in genetics and crossbreeding of specimens. So you would have one digital drawing or artwork that was generated based on some kind of chromosome, and then you would have another one, and then it could procreate and crossbreed, and they would have offspring.
That's cool.
And I made that, and I put it on, I made a smart contract, and I had the exhibition open. I made a DApp, I think they were still called like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, nobody cared. Nobody understood. And that was also fine. And then I made a series of physical objects that were like materialized. I called it frozen versions of those digital crossbred specimen that what would also be possible to have them on chain. And I looked for a way to visualize the breeding algorithm, and I made that into a standalone installation on a big screen in the gallery. And I thought I had just made that visualization just to make people understand why the physical artworks were interesting, like for didactic purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But then people wanted to buy the digital work. And that was unexpected for me.
Uh-huh.
And that, because that's a whole other thing. NFT solve some aspects of the question of digital art. But that art piece was not necessarily primarily intended as an NFT. It was it's a digital installation to be shown in a space.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when it got sold, I also had to configure a computer with it. And the computer had to run every day forever.
Yeah.
and computers don't tend to do that. And
what?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's so many questions around, like, what is the artwork the computer? Is the disc the artwork?
Right. Or
so many questions. And I mean, I love when people want to own my digital work, but I'm always also a bit annoyed because there's still not, as far as I know, one single solution of a computer that just works, that is fast, that is affordable, and that has no moving parts.
So
I love and I've been very, very obsessed with it lately to make plotter drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And they float somehow between the file and the tangible rusty object.
Yeah. I love it. I love plotting.
I know you do.
I think most people know I do at this point.
Yeah. It's like here in Berlin, you also mentioned Marcel Schlitnik.
Schwitlik.
He lives not. So there's this erupting, emerging plotter enthusiast circle in Berlin.
I just like physical things. I mean, I've also got, like, I'm getting, you know, 3D printer and this laser cutter that Holger Lippmann just gave us. And like, I have big ideas, and I have plans that I've been drawing for the last few years about, like, some ideas to fit into some things. I'm really looking forward to playing around with and making them. It's kind of a, it's machines, man, just working with machines.
Yeah. Well, I love plotters and the newer ones, they also have more surface.
Yeah.
Like they get a bit bigger, which is good. But still, I want to go larger. So I started drawing, plotter drawings by hand. Just crazy.
It's so cool.
Yeah, it's very meditative. Yeah. And I'm pretty tidy when I'm coding. Uh-huh. But I'm not very tidy when I'm making things.
So explain this now. What are you doing exactly?
I calculate, algorithmically generate images.
Uh-huh.
And then I project little marking information on a paper.
Uh-huh.
And then I copy those marks. And from those marks with my ruler, I can start to construct the actual image. And of course, doing that introduces my mistakes,
yeah,
and errors, and that's kind of also the point.
Yeah.
But also, I can go much larger, and because when something is hanging on the wall, I want it to have some kind of relationship to this, the size of my body, and to to be there. So that's, yeah, I think I'm going more towards paper and pencils and rulers.
Yeah.
And yeah. Which also, of course, fits in this thing I was telling earlier about my practice to be more like a daily practice and commitment to that. It feels really satisfying to, I did 1,000 lines today with pencil. Not those lines. No.
Yeah, that's always kind of nice, too, whenever you look at the stuff that you did by your own self. It's pretty good. When you were growing up, did you attend a lot of like art events and stuff, or did you were you interested in that at all, or was it something completely weird and you found it later?
I always drew. Uh-huh. I always liked making drawings. I would go outside and sit at the canal and draw trees.
Uh-huh.
I liked computer games as well, and I discovered MS Paint really early.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was all sort of one and the same thing of making images.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know. I liked computers so much, and I started programming QBasic around 12 years old, I think. But that was not, I didn't visit many museums, or my parents didn't take me to those kind of things.
Uh-huh.
So when I graduated high school, it was obvious that I was going to study computer science.
Uh-huh.
But I still had this idea in mind, that because what I did with the computer were making images.
Yeah, yeah.
But at university, they were completely not interested,
yeah,
in making images. They were more about making proofs.
Yeah.
Proofs for theorems, mm-hmm, and optimization problems.
Yeah.
And also, there were no women. That's very important. There were only men.
That's very important. I do agree. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I didn't finish my studies of computer science.
No.
No, I went to art school.
Yeah, where'd you go to art school?
The Rietveld Academy in Amsterdam.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In, at the Rietveld Academy, they didn't care about my algorithms.
Yeah. How did they view you? What did they think about you?
Yeah, well, when I did the entrance exam, I showed them things on my laptop, and also later in the first year of art school, I showed them things on my laptop that I had made, that I had programmed. And they were looking fascinated, but looking at me like, and so they didn't understand that the thing I was showing on my screen, that was the final work.
Uh-huh.
They only knew the computer as a tool to in the end achieve something, which actually maybe they were right. That's what I'm doing now. I'm making drawings, but no, I believe
you had to get there. You had to get there.
Yeah, it
takes time. Yeah, sure.
Yes. Yeah. No, I have advocated for the browser,
yeah,
the computer as a full experiential art, and I still believe that it is.
It, for sure.
Yeah, but it is specific. It has its particular capabilities and limitations.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not the only one. For a while, I kind of insisted that it was the only one.
Really?
Yeah, I was only doing digital art and net art for the browser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand being solo-minded on a specific way of doing things. I like to work on paper, and I like to use specific pens. I get it, you know? But I do also like to fuck around with other shit. You know, I mean, it is kind of fun to go and do other things. I think the browser is an amazing, the browser is just such a cool, it's such a badass tool. Yeah.
It's an operating system.
Man, it's so cool. I know. Yeah. It's amazing what it's done. Yeah. It's gone from these simple things to.
Yeah. And it has very particular characteristics, because if you would make a painting for a particular wall, and you would hang that same painting on a different wall, you don't expect the painting to shrink and reconfigure the image.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about
And we do with digital works.
Yeah, we do. Well, because we just don't think about scale in that sense, because this is a, you know, this is a thing is no matter what.
Yeah, you don't have scale, but you have aspect ratio.
Yeah.
That is very particular for digital art.
Yeah, it is. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. It can also be destructive if you make your window in a really weird aspect ratio. So it's fluid. You make something, you make some rules, and something comes out, but you never can be really sure what it's going to be, which is the beauty, of course. But it runs counter to the idea of the art market, where things have to be fixed and clear and kind of monumental to commodify them.
You think?
I think so. Because if to stand the time, mm-hmm, and to know what you have, to have something. I mean, I guess maybe that was the origin of art from the start, was to take the ever-changing complexity of life and history and what happened and make a mark, erect a totem, erect a sculpture from some kind of material that would not immediately vaporize. So it's going from this fluidity and change, it's going to this fixating something or keeping it stable. I think it's like sculpture, like any kind of art in a way. Well, not performance art, but. And digital media, they refuse that. They're built on, they're like sandcastles in a way. I shouldn't say this to my collectors.
It's not exactly true, but it's okay.
Yeah. But sandcastle is in the sense that the foundation of the digital artwork, which is it requires all these other layers of technology, mm-hmm, not just your screen, but also all the dependencies that your software runs on, mm-hmm, and the expectations of the speed of the computer, and all these will change. So this is the fundament you build your artwork on, but you can be sure that in 10 years, all those requirements, these dependencies, will not be true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing though, right? I mean, it's... This is the gamble. This is the game.
Yeah.
You this build for now. It's the immediacy game. I mean, there is a bit of to that. You know, I mean, there's something to be said for keeping things in the immediate. Artists have been using cardboard and things like this. You know, those are also immediate ideas. But when you're trying to actually not be immediate, it's pretty difficult in the digital realm. It's pretty hard to, like...
Yeah.
Find your way out of it.
So that's what interested me in blockchain from the start, because mm-hmm, it kind of does that a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Dieter Roth, the artist who was making these images or paintings with food, mm-hmm, knowing that it would rot. And he makes these beautiful zines or all these publications. He would have been so interested in digital art, I think.
Yeah.
But he was just too early or too young. It wasn't really there yet.
Yeah. Happens that way for some of these people, many of them, as a matter of fact. Yeah. But we needed them before to come to these conclusions that we're coming, mm-hmm, to now. So when you got into the academy and you started working with them and you were showing them what the ultimate thing, they wanted you to physically output it, right? They were thinking that it was going to be used as a tool for a physical output thing. In that moment, when you made that stance, no, it's about the browser and it's about showing the work in this browser, What was there? What, not just the professors, but the people around you that were like, how did the painters feel about what you were doing? Or, you know, how did the sculptors feel about that? How did they talk to you about that at all? Or were you just kind of like on an island?
Well, yeah. So they were familiar with animation. Mm-hmm. So I was making a lot of flash animation.
Yeah.
So they could look at them as video. That made sense to them.
Yeah, sure.
And they were very fascinated when things were interactive, because that was something specific that you could do with digital media, like something happens when you click on it.
Yeah.
So that worked. And but I was a bit annoyed and dissatisfied. I mean, I had a great time, but I was also rebelling a bit, I guess. So I joined the student council and the newspaper and stuff. And then when I graduated art school, I started teaching right after graduation. A little bit like how I interpreted was like, oh, okay, Harm, you were Mr. Know-it-all, so now you can teach as if you know how to do that. and that was fun. Yeah, I did that for about 4 years.
Oh, cool. What did you teach specifically?
I was in the graphic design department.
Okay.
Digital media and interaction design.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was in my post-internet vibe.
Yeah.
So I tried to stimulate them to not necessarily do digital media.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also very fascinating because at the graphic design department, I was very interested in web design and interaction design. And I also had the programming experience to do that, to teach that. But these students, they wanted to make books.
Yeah.
Because for them, the internet, they were slightly younger than me, and they had not, for them, the internet had just always been there.
Yeah.
And they were completely not impressed by it.
Yeah.
And at that time, when they encountered the internet, it was already starting to break down with advertisement and Facebook and all this crap.
Yeah.
So for them, that was not a very admirable stage for their artistic production.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to be a post on a Facebook feed.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
And there was a certain sadness to that. And I suddenly felt old in a way, that I was like this WWW hippie saying you can do anything, animation, sound, interactive video. It's amazing. And they were like, no, I'd rather make books.
Yeah.
And it's much more beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, whatever. You know, books are good too.
Sure.
When was the last time you read a book?
Oh, I have one next to my bed.
Yeah.
It's a it's kind of a self-help book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I meant more like a novel.
Ooh. No, I don't even remember. I don't have the attention anymore to read novels.
Uh-huh.
I find myself skimming the page, and there's some kind of elaborate epic description of a landscape or a hero, or I'm like, I just find myself skimming the line, like, where's the factual information that I need to know to follow the story. I cannot do it anymore. It's sad. Yeah,
I have that same problem. That's super crazy. I mean, you've said a couple of things that it's just like, yeah, or straight up, I have that exact same thing. I'm looking through it, I'm like, damn, I want to just kind of know what's happening here. I don't care about all of this.
What is the mind picture? TLDR. Yeah. Yeah. That's not how to approach a novel, TLDR.
It's not.
No.
It's not. No. I mean, I read a lot of nonfiction, and I find myself reading that. It's just when I pick up any kind of fiction, even like good stuff, I'm doing that shit, and it's crazy. I feel really weird. I feel like I can't enjoy those mind pictures from books like that any longer. It's hard.
Yeah, it might have something to do with how we, because people say that, like, people don't read anymore, and it's true if you limit that to novels.
Yeah,
but also I believe I'm reading the whole day every day on my phone, and I'm consuming tweets every day.
Yep,
and I think we're reading more than ever,
for sure.
It's just very fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And there's maybe some kind of greater narrative that you can extract from all those fragments, but it's only dystopian, I think.
I think the last book I read was Neal Stephenson's Dodge. and they're taking this cross country in the United States. They're going across the United States, and the United States is already fractured, and it's turning into this really, it's kind of it's a pretty apocalyptic place. It's pretty weird, but they all wear their feeds on their eyes, and they're talking about how they have these feed curators, you know, and like, it's not so far. Yeah. I mean, maybe the Civil War part is in the United States is maybe not so far either, but like it's not as real as that book. But the feed curator concept, I don't think that's far at all.
Like goggles?
Maybe it's not goggles, but maybe it's like something in your ear so you're getting news. Maybe it's just a little something across the bottom, but some sort of like connection. I don't think that the Apple goggle thing is the way to go. I don't think that that's the... I can't imagine, you know, watching Murlocs walking around on the street like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. How fast are you going to get ripped off?
I was watching this lecture by Sadie Plante at the ICA. It was in 1994. Uh-huh. It was a symposium organized by Virtual Futures. Uh-huh. And it was about this. So it's quite a while ago. Bruce Sterling was also there. Mm-hmm. And Sadie Plante was discussing how the dematerialization project in general, the greater project, has this desire to disconnect take distance from the material body, mm-hmm. and the flesh, the meat, the blood, like all the meat space, and favor a higher immaterial, perfect, like Socratic, of Platonic idealist reality and aesthetics, and how that is in itself a white patriarchic idea, and that it denies the reality of having a body and having and being fragile, and she connects it to feminist discourse of the women as the bearer of life and the creator of life and having a period every month, like those are like real things, flesh embodied experiences and nourishing the body, nourishing life, nourishing all these things, which are within digital media kind of all annoying things to pretend they're not there and looking for this perfect mathematical reality. Mm-hmm. So I found that very interesting, and the striving for digital perfection is in a way, there's also something disturbing about it, and things like Google goggles or what are they?
Yeah. Well,
they all seem to want to go more in that dematerialized, disembodied direction. And I know from my own mental health that I need to actually pull myself back to myself, to my body. I have to not dematerialize into my head. I should not become just a pattern of electric pulses going, but I should actually go the other direction, feel my body, be in my body, take care of my body, take care of the people around me, which is very, again, I guess that's also a feminist or feminine trait. And so this has been on my mind a lot. And I guess that's why I like to make these plotter drawings, mm-hmm. also because they're kind of unpredictable and material, and they require dedication and nurturing. And yeah, these are I can send you the link of the lecture by Sadie Plante.
Yeah, please do, and then we'll put it in the show notes. Yeah, that's a good idea. Like, I really, that's a, you've got me spun out, man. I'm kind of thinking about that versus like how I didn't think you were going to drop it on the white patriarchy level there, and once you hit that, it was like, yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah, all of that. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just not, I've never really put it in that way. I mean, I've always kind of thought of nature as being like as being mathematical perfection, right? I mean, like in my my mind, I feel like we do very complicated processes just to take a step, you know? And then when we're stepping on that, we're also stepping on a very complicated process of these materials that came together in this really in a random but very well put together way to allow us to step on it, you know? And
yeah, and also these different, let's say, realities are not contradicting.
I mean
the laws of physics or
cheers
or mathematics are at play in these embodied complex nonlinear systems. I guess that's exactly what I'm trying to make by using some rules to create this kind of resonating complexity. Mm-hmm. To because my recent plotter drawings are based on an algorithm made by Vera Molnar, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it connects, so the line has only a few possibilities. It's a very basic, simple algorithm. But I can, because our computers are so much faster now, I can put this algorithm on steroids and apply it in where she had like a grid of, let's say, 20 by 20 or 30 by 30 cells. I can have 3,000 cells, and the work that initially started off as so geometric and kind of within this, let's say, disembodied perfection, when it's applied on steroids recursively, so much in so much more depth, the organic structures seem to start to present themselves, which was kind of that's one of those lucky accidents. Mm-hmm. that you always pray for to happen.
That's cool. I want to see this. I want to go over it. Where can I see this?
Well, they're in my studio right now, but they're also on my website. I've only taken self photos of it, but there are some exhibitions coming up in the summer where these drawings will be shown.
Here in Berlin?
One is at Lohaus Saminski in München.
Uh huh.
It's early September.
Uh huh.
And an exhibition in Tokyo.
Oh, it's cool.
A bit further away.
That's a little far. I'm not going to catch that one. Maybe. Never know. Yeah.
And there will be a summer group show at Dom Gallery here in Berlin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Who's in that?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
You know,
I'm excited to find out. Yes. I'll find that out because that's exciting.
Ask Wolf.
Yeah. I haven't been over to see the show that's up currently. There was the Plotter show that was up like last. Yes. And there's a new show up, huh?
I've not so long ago been there. Uh-huh. I think it also had drawings by Marcel.
Yeah, that was the one that was the last one that I saw there too. I haven't seen. Right. I think there might be a new one up, but I don't know. Okay. I don't have any idea. I can't, man. I'm trying to keep up with all that stuff, but
oh, I don't.
Oh man, I actually don't try. It's true. If I really wanted to, I would figure it out. But instead, I'd rather be doing the other things that I'm doing most of the time. And then every now and then be like, what's going on over at Dam?
Oh, I suddenly remember the name of the gallery that we were speaking about earlier. It's Noah Klink.
Ah, that's right.
Of course.
Yes, of course.
Sorry, Noah.
Yeah.
Noah Klink in Schöneberg.
Yeah, yeah. That was a nice place, too. It was like in the floor of that.
I enjoyed that show.
Yeah. Is he still doing shows there?
Oh, yeah. I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Does he represent you or do you just work with him?
No, this was more an incidental occasion, I think.
Cool. Gotcha. Yeah, it's always kind of tough. I think that there's a very few people who get how this kind of, well, specifically who get what you're doing, like kind of an overall, like big picture of what's going on with you. I think it's pretty difficult for people to grasp. And I think that it takes a very special person to, you know, that you can work with and foster a relationship with. I would imagine it's pretty hard for you.
Well, yeah. To explain somebody how something was made.
Yeah.
How do you say that? So, I mean, I would like everybody to appreciate my work for the image that it is, how it appears to them, regardless of if they know how it was made, but of course, I like them to understand how that was made, and I also try to not impress with technical skill.
Mm.
So actually, the technology that I use is generally not so cutting edge.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to impress with that.
Yeah.
Master that part. I want there to be a possibility of explaining how it was made to people who did not study computer science.
Yeah.
But still, how it is made is important for the...
How it is made, I meant it less about that, because I think like how is the next step, but why you make what you make is probably is quite difficult for people to grasp, I think. I think it. I'm still trying to get my head around why you do what you do.
The reason why?
Yeah.
Yeah, well...
Whatever you're going to tell me is probably going to be partially true.
I just really, there's something transcendent in it.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully in the experience of viewing it, but definitely in the experience of making it.
Yeah.
To look at the world and to look at all the things that I'm bored by.
Yeah.
That sounds a bit arrogant, but there's a sense of arrogance. Like, yeah, because, you have like to. If you take all that has been made in the world, and then I come and I say, well, excuse me, but I have something to add to that. Because to some extent, I don't like all those other things. There's a sense of truth in that. And I make because it helps me understand the fabric of nature or perception, mm-hmm. or these kind of big topics.
Yeah.
And I find it really rewarding. And even more so now that my practice is more about this daily practice,
mm-hmm.
instead of suffering for a long time before finally something comes out. I mean, there's always the part of suffering, which is also fun to do something technically complicated in terms of programming. And it doesn't immediately come with the result. So you kind of have to trust that, okay, I have to give it another... few weeks before finally something will come out,
mm-hmm.
that, or when I don't even know if it's possible at all.
Yeah,
and there's an excitement to that as well, but there's also it can be a bit masochistic. Yeah,
both of those things I understand so well.
Yeah, I mean it's great, and that's something that with the rise and fall of NFTs.
Uh-huh. Have they fallen? I haven't noticed.
No. Well, they haven't fallen.
I think that we've got more of them every day.
Yeah, but I mean, I still love them. But no, what I wanted to say is that since that I have been, I mean, my career was already going towards breaking point.
Yeah.
But with that 2021, it was... I'm so grateful that I can work.
Yeah.
I can have a life
and
I can be in my studio. I used to work in startups, but pretending I gave a shit about their product.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love to code. I was a full stack web developer, but then the people around me, my coworkers, began getting younger and younger. And I was at a point where that was during COVID, when I was looking for a new freelance client, they looked at my resume and they said, well, we can offer you kind of like a manager position you've been doing this for longer. So it doesn't make sense to use you as a coder, mm-hmm. but would you like to be a product owner or something like that? And I'm like, hell no.
No,
no, no.
I don't want to do that. I like the idea of coding,
yeah.
Not managing people, man. It's like what they do with comedians, right? You know, they do give them a show so that they can do everything but comedy. Oh. Like that's kind of, it seems to be that that's how it works. They work up to getting some show on TV and then they become an actor.
Yes.
And be told, hey, you have to learn how to do that seriously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty funny. Do you listen to music whenever you're coding? Can you do it?
I listen to specific music while coding, like mm-hmm. instrumental, kind of ambient, soundscape. But the same music I use for meditation.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this person called Milieu on Bandcamp.
Mm-hmm.
and I think it's a he. He makes beautiful soundscape. It's algorithmic, so he has like a bunch of modular synthesizers with some generative sequencers, and he just lets the thing run for half an hour, and that's the track you buy on Bandcamp.
Great.
And I love because it actually has no time anymore. There's no, I mean, there is a beginning and end, but it's kind of a status. It's like it's stasis. I mean, so I can do that while coding.
Have you ever listened to Novoline?
Novoline.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think you might like that. It's also partially generative, and it is generative. I mean, he builds everything from old machines, and the song randomly gets generated, and then he builds the beats and stuff around that. Like, so it's kind of fun what he's up there doing. He's performed over here in the church before.
Oh, cool.
There's some pretty fascinating shit.
This weekend is the Super Booth Fair.
Is it?
Yeah.
We used to have little things in here after Super Booth, like a couple of times, like a few of the, I don't remember which one, Pittsburgh Modular and one of the other ones came over and did like little shows and DJed inside Keith.
Lovely.
Yeah. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm going there with my son as well. And sick. I hope he's 12 and I hope to, maybe he's even listening. I know him. to make him enthusiastic about modular synthesis, which is also dangerous because these things are very expensive.
And boy,
very
are addictive. They.
Yeah. No, it's I also go for the fetish of it. Like I have all those blinking lights and beautiful knobs and faders and everything. So I'm looking forward to that.
I toured in this band for a bunch of years, and what I played was a bunch of blinking lights and knobs. It was like having an airport that I was kind of controlling myself, you know, like being directly over the top of this thing and moving down.
Yeah, I love that, and sometimes I wonder, or I hope that that using a plotter is not kind of this similar fetishization of of an analog medium. There's just like rhizograph, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I love all these things, and I want to use them to artistic means.
Yeah.
And I think it's possible.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, I tend to not really push the plotter aspect of what I'm working on. I try to talk about like the drawings, you know, themselves in the end of the final work.
Yeah, but I think it's also important that people know how they were.
Yeah,
because if they think it's just nothing wrong with that. But if it's just a digital print, which is also cool, but they are unique in that sense.
Yeah,
and they can never have be the same one twice.
Exactly.
And I think that's very important for the for the essence of the thing.
I had a bit of a row with this last gallerist that I was working with and this other thing. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I had a little conversation about like how these things don't really produce editions. You know, the editions, and she's like, what do you mean? And I was like, it's not how this works. Mm-hmm. Each one of these things is unique.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, but I need editions works. And I was like, well, I can make edition works, but not with a plotter. I have to cut it from wood or, you know, do something else. And she was like, no, you can do it with the plotter. It's like, it doesn't work. Maybe she getting it together was very difficult for her.
It's a little bit like silk screen, right? Because I believe the SIF gets stuck after a while. You can only do so many with one. Is it called SIF?
Screen.
There's one screen. You can only do so many. So there's an optimum moment. And maybe it's comparable like that.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I like to make. I'm working with Novoline right now on a project.
Right.
That's silk screening and plotting together.
Cool.
And yeah, it's kind of a funny idea, but I'm hoping that the silk screens all look the same.
Yeah, or embrace the imperfection and.
Or embrace it. Yeah. But I kind of need it to not be so much like for some of them. But anyway, yeah, that's a whole nother story. Yes. Hey, Harm, we're up against it.
Yeah, it was a true pleasure.
Yeah, that was awesome. Super fast. I hate that one when they just move so quickly. Because I always wish that, you know, like there are some times when I'm wishing that this show was 2 hours long. But other times I think I don't want to listen to a 2-hour show. So I feel like 1 hour is perfect.
Yeah, we have to respect our listeners.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, thanks for coming on. I really do appreciate
it. True pleasure. Thank you.
And again, if you guys did enjoy listening to us and you want to throw money at keeping this thing alive, this is how the studio stays alive. Throw it to the PayPal at keithfm.com, or you can hit me up at idontlikepodcast.tez. Thanks a lot for listening.